please help me welcome our speaker tonight. It's Dan from Stepping Stones.
Hi, guys. My name's Dan. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Dan.
You hear a lot of times people will get up, especially at our speakers, and say, I have a sponsor. I know my sponsor and my sponsor's sponsor. And you'll hear in my story that it's going to be obvious that I have a sponsor. I wouldn't be standing up here right now. So I don't feel the need to say that. Because that word unmanageable was prevalent throughout my life before I discovered I had alcoholism, through all the relapses. Like, I have a sobriety date that's November 14th of 2020. I can stand up here and say that wasn't my first sober date. I'm a recovered person in AA right now because of God in AA and the teachers that I've met in AA throughout. The first time I tried to get sober was in 2006, so that tells you a lot. I've had, over that first 4 or 5 years, I would just come to meetings and hold on to my chair. I didn't understand that the bedevilments were already, we read about the bedevilments in our book. They were prevalent in my life back then, but I didn't even know what they were. I didn't understand that coming into the rooms, some people had that misconception of the alcohol was my problem or the drugs were my problem, and drugs played a big part in my story. I'm going to try and keep it in the bottle as much as possible. But they were just my solution for a long time. And you took away my solution, then I was just left with me. And we'll get to that. I want to thank Shay for inviting me out here. Dave and her husband Dave and Shay, I've known them a long time. I've actually known them since I came around AA for the first time. For a long time. Dave and my friend Frank, who's with me, have watched me struggle in AA. Keep hitting my head against the wall because I had a problem with that surrender piece. I thought I was surrendering, but like, step three is one of the biggest steps in the world, that we surrender everything. Like, I've always had a problem, even before picking up that first drink and then throughout my drinking career and all that and drug career, of surrendering everything. Like, because even as a chef, like, I have to be in control of certain things. I'm an executive chef. Like, in my personal life, I have to be in control of certain things. And even in sobriety, all those times, I would think I was surrendering stuff, but I wasn't fully surrendering my life to God. There's a reason I had my eyes closed during the readings over there, because I was asking God to speak through me tonight. Like, because if I don't ask God to work through me in every day, and especially at an AA meeting when I'm asked to share, all you're going to hear is ego. Like, I'm an ego-driven person when I don't invite God into my life. And I don't even know it. Until it slaps me in the face with alcoholism and I'm back out there again. So I'm going to just talk for a while and just talk about what it was like at first. And I want to say hi to everyone on Zoom. I have friends. I mentioned some of those teachers in AA that I had. My buddy Bob down in Florida, he's one of my teachers. He said he was going to be watching. I have friends in Philadelphia. As she said, my home group's the Stepping Stones. If you ever want to come out on a Sunday night at 7 o'clock, that's my specific home group meeting at the Stepping Stones in Northeast Philadelphia. But I wanted to say hi to everyone on Zoom. My first drink happened in seventh grade. I was on student council at St. William's at the local Catholic grade school that I attended in Longcrest in Northeast Philadelphia. And we'd have our, once a month, have our meetings at lunch, and they'd let us eat first, and the little nun that ran our student council meetings wouldn't be in there while we're eating our lunch. And I turned around and I saw the hot eighth grade cheerleader pouring some of her Snapple out in a trash can, and then she reached in her school bag and poured something else in. Now I said, I had never had the guts to speak to this girl up to this point. I asked her what it was, and she said, "Vodka, do you want some?" And without even thinking, yes. Now, I didn't have that white light moment that you hear a lot of people have their first drink, but I'll tell you what it did for me. I was able to make that girl laugh, and I was comfortable trying to make that girl laugh before the nun came in. And it's not like I went and got wasted afterwards or started drinking every night. I mean, I didn't try to start drinking on a regular basis till high school. Like, we'd drink back tracks and all the parties when friends' parents went away and stuff like that. But that's when it took off a little bit, like the drinking, but it never was an issue, at least back then. But that white light moment happened later in high school when the first time I tried the smokable form that gives you the munchies. And my friend Rachel Billows said it best. I never heard it put this way until I heard her speak in a meeting the one time, and then I was like, wow, that's me. The first time I tried that hamster wheel stopped spinning a million miles an hour, and I was like, whew. I had finally found what I liked. And for the next decade or more, I did that every day. I'm standing up here. I didn't start having truly strong negative consequences from what developed into my alcoholism till my late 20s. But I went to Roman Catholic High School downtown, got decent grades, worked as a kid, tried to play sports, went to Villanova on a partial scholarship. But I got to Villanova, and that's where my alcoholism took over a little bit more, because I was around these kids that had a lot of money, and they were going out partying every night, and they were able to make the class the next day, and I would go smoke weed. And of course, going to a school like Villanova, any university for that matter, if you're not showing up for class and turning in your assignments, they're going to ask you to leave. And I got placed on academic probation my first semester, and then the next semester, I just left without being asked to leave. And by that point, I started dabbling with cooking. I got a few odd jobs. I worked at a law firm for a little while downtown. Even back then, people would hand me things. Like, I would get afforded opportunities that I just didn't understand how to be grateful for, like that people were trying to look out for me. And that even occurred later on in my drinking career, where I started having all those consequences, and over and over and over again, people would always be like, "Dan, here, we'll pick you back up. Dan, here, we'll pick you back up." Whether it was my parents, aunts and uncles, people from the neighborhood that had strong ties, and whether it was politically or jobs or whatever. But I was doing well in my early 20s. I started cooking and I loved it. And I decided that was the career I wanted to go with. And by the time I was 28, I was working for Steven Starr. I was on the opening team at the Barclay Prime. His steakhouse is still open down in Rittenhouse Square. That was my professional, you have arrived moment. And like I said, I dabbled in some things in my 20s. Like, I was a drink to get foobar person. I was never the type to go out for a couple of beers. If I was going out, it was normally, not necessarily a blackout, but a lot of times it was. But I never thought I had a problem because I always showed up for work and my bills were paid for the most part. But those little cracks, like, started happening. I would lose a job because I was late too many times because of the weed. Which sounds stupid at the time, but those little things started happening. And I was on, like I said, I was on that opening team at the Barclay Prime, and we were on the Food Network. Like, we got four bells. I'm living downtown. On the outside, looking in, everything's great. At the time, I didn't understand the bedevilments that I mentioned were already taking hold in my life. And I was using whatever source that I could to cover those things up, whether it was the weed, it was drinking constantly, gambling was a big problem back then. I was constantly going to Atlantic City with this one other line cook. And then I met her. And when I met her for the first time, at the end of that night, she offered me something that she poured out on the table, just like that drink. First drink, I'm staring at a pretty girl, and I don't blame the females. I don't want that to be misconstrued. This is all my people pleasing and my alcoholism, where I can't think of the consequences. I just want to feel good, and I want to feel good around her. And when she offered that to me, I said yes. So at the time, I'm working at the Barclay Prime, making great money. It took me almost 10 years after that to make that kind of money again. Like, things are amazing. Within trying that first line, within a year and a month, I don't know if anyone's familiar with the clothespin building downtown in Center City. It's right across from City Hall. I was at the time, the Sovereign Bank was right on, as soon as you walked into the clothespin building. Within a year and a month of me trying that first line, I was walking into that bank and handing an elderly black woman who was the bank teller a note. That's where my disease takes me. Just chilling to running my head into a wall. That's my alcoholism. And that could happen today. Like, if that cup of coffee I have right here, and I'm going to get to that part of the disease, if this was Jameson or Yingling, two of my favorite things in my drinking career, and I just took a sip like Jim when he thought he could put that whiskey into milk, that phenomenon of craving is instantly, there's no question in my mind going to take hold. And we stopped at Wawa on the way here. You might see me panhandling outside that Wawa for my next one within a couple months. That's where my disease takes me. Goodbye, beautiful condo apartment in Old City. Goodbye, the relationship with my ex's children, who I still consider my children, like my stepchildren. Goodbye, the relationship with my family. All of that thrown right out the window. That's the seriousness of this disease for me. So, of course, I'm not a great criminal. So I got caught almost immediately a week later. I'm surprised it took that long. But again, I discussed how people were constantly picking Dan back up. Pick Dan, we gotta help him. And my I went up the state road, to CFCF, one of the max jails on state road in Philadelphia, and 5 days later, they took me down and have a bail reducement hearing, and of course, those people that are constantly trying to pick me up, and one of them, Thomas Campion, who's been sober in this program forever, he's from my neighborhood. He's got pretty decent political ties. He got me a great lawyer. My family reached out to him. They got the bail reduced. I got bailed out the next day on a Saturday. My dad picked me up, and he's driving. I said, where are you taking? Where are we going? Because we drove right past Fox Chase. I'm thinking we're going to their house in Fox Chase. He was like, your mom doesn't want to see you right now. And we went. My grandmother wasn't home at the time. We went to her house. They let me get a shower. My Aunt Eileen ordered me food, and then he dropped me off at that same guy's house. And he doesn't mind me using his name. Campy's been a good member of this program for almost 3 decades now. They dropped me off at his house, and another one of his friends from AA came, and we get in his car, and we're driving, and we start driving down Frankfort, what I know now is a 12-step call, and we start getting into Kensington, and I had never even been in Kensington because of my disease at that point yet. And I said, Campy, where are you taking me? And he was like, I'm dropping you off at a recovery house. And it was at Frankfort and Tioga. I was like, how the hell am I supposed to stay sober down here? He was like, kid, I could drop you. Well, he used my nickname from growing up, Thunder. He was like, Thunder, I could drop you off in Alaska. If you want to get high, you're going to get to find the Eskimo that's got what you need. But I could also drop you off down here. And if you do what you're told from people that know in this program, you can stay sober in this beast down there. And I know people today that still live down there and stay sober. I wouldn't want to live there anymore, but needless to say, I started going to meetings and I was in a lot of legal trouble. That powerful attorney helped get me a sentence of 2 years house arrest followed by a very long paper trail, 5 years probation, because luckily I had never had any legal troubles before that, and I was afforded all those opportunities of all those strong ties that some people don't get. Like I was being being handed a gift horse in the mouth. Like I was literally I 2 weeks prior to that, I had robbed a bank because I owed someone a lot of money. And I was scared that my alcoholism was going to affect my family. So I didn't see any other way out. I came up with this harebrained scheme and had a plan on that I'm going to get rid of the clothes and get rid of that, and I'll never get caught. But like I said, I got caught. So I got introduced to AA for the first time. As I said, like I would just go to meetings for years, and I would hear people say something. Let's say Frank said something amazing in a meeting, and I would go to another meeting and parrot that, thinking I knew what the hell I was talking about. I didn't realize just how sick and delusional I was. Because that's part of my disease too, like that delusion of grandeur, the ego. Like, and I would raise my hand at business meetings and chair the meetings, and I thought I was hot shit and like trying to chase girls and all the wrong stuff that we come into these rooms and will keep you sick. I did them. And I got what I got. Because needless to say, without my solution, which was alcohol and drugs, I'm still left with me. Until that pain gets great enough, and it's going to look good on the outside. It's happened a million times for me. It's going to look good on the outside. I had a great job as a sous chef in Manayunk. I had money in my pocket. Like, my family was supporting me, like, all those great things looked until one day, just like Jim with that first drop of whiskey in the milk, suddenly, I was on my way home for work, And that was the first time this happened, and it wasn't the last, unfortunately. Boom. I'm just going to get one. Needless to say, I ended up in jail, ended up in my first rehab, still getting light slaps on the wrist. Met the mother of my daughter, Josie, in rehab. The rehab romance. Like, because I was there for 90 days, she came in within my last 3 weeks, and then she moved to Philly to be with me in the wonderful neighborhood of Frankfurt, and we're living in a sober house, and 3 months later we discovered she was pregnant. At the time I had already started messing up again, so I got honest with her, I'm gonna go get sober now because I'm gonna be a dad. Because one thing I didn't bring up yet is my family. My mom and dad are still together to this day. They've been together since 1970. Well, they got married in 72. They dated for a long time before that. Two amazing parents that did everything for me and my sister growing up. Like, my dad would work two jobs to make sure we had whatever they thought we needed. Put us through Catholic school, try to, just like every parent wants better for their children than that they have, that's what my parents did for us. And I was looking at that role model aspect of, like, I have two great parents, I gotta live up to that thing now. So I went away to get sober, but everyone sitting here right now can probably attest, like, we can't get sober for anyone else. We can use it as motivation, but, like, that unmanageable piece is always going to be inside us. I can't, and, like, I tried to explain it to loved ones when, like, where is your willpower? Like, you have a kid now, or where is your, like, we don't have willpower when it comes to our disease. We don't. Like, I know I don't. If you're an alcoholic like me, and I don't have the solution outlined in this book, I'm screwed. It's a ticking time bomb. And that can happen sober, too. Like I said, I've had multiple years living in the solution, helping other people, living a great life until I gradually stopped doing what got me all that. Stopped going to God in the morning. Stop going to so many meetings. Stop doing an inventory. Stop doing all these things at work that I'm going to hit later on in this meeting until that suddenly happens again. And almost every time, on the outside, things looked great. I'll tell you, he's watched it happen time and time and time again. If this isn't first in my life, and don't get me wrong, I love my parents, I love my family, I love my friends and my job, but I can't put any of them in front of this. So going back, I thought I was going to stay sober because I'm going to be a dad now. And watching my dad working his butt off for us growing up, in my sick, twisted thinking, I gotta get a second job. Because now we're gonna have a kid and we wanna get a house in Fishtown and all of this great stuff, and we have to start our American family on the outside now. Until a month before my daughter was born, and we had the house in Fishtown at that point, I'm about to get off the L because I was working downtown and getting off the L at Girard, and that suddenly thought happened. I'm like, you know what? I'm getting off at Burks. And the guy laughed at me when I said, can I just get two? He was like, here's my phone number. I'll see you later tonight. And he did probably 6 or 7 times that night, that first night. Now, I have a pregnant girlfriend in the third floor of our small Trinity house in Fishtown. She worked up until 2 weeks before she gave birth as a She worked at a hair salon as a color specialist in Rittenhouse Square, so by the time I got home from work every night, she was already upstairs. The only day I was sober from that point on until November 7th of 2008, when I got put in handcuffs again, was the day my daughter was born. And it's sad to say that it was hard as hell to even stay sober that day, because that phenomenon of craving had taken over again. And then within that first couple weeks, now my alcoholism was telling me I'm a scumbag. You're going to be a father and you're doing this. Until I got suicidal, like one of those other bedevilments started attacking me. The depression, and Vicky took my daughter home to Pottstown, where she was from, a week before the Phillies won the World Series. Sorry, I always associate memories with sports events or concerts, but I left my house a day later on a suicide mission. I just didn't have the guts to put that gun in my mouth. And luckily I hadn't tried that other hard form of alcohol yet. Keyword yet. Or I would have tried to put it in my arm and died instantly. But I wanted to die, because I literally had reached that low of, I'm not going to be a good father, so they'll be better off without me. That's where my alcoholism was taking me. So I did what I did a few years earlier, but I thought I could smoke the form of alcohol I was using enough until my heart exploded. And it never happened. And that day I got arrested, I was up on the L platform at York Dock and L Stop. I had finally made the decision. I was literally at that jumping off point. And God saw fit that an off-duty SEPTA officer recognized me when I was walking up to that train station. The FBI and the police were looking for me for a week and a half. My family and loved ones were dry. This is what we put our families through, and not to compare your situations to mine, but like, we all have put our loved ones through some crap. This is the crap I put my family through. My dad and my cousins were driving around Kensington every night looking for me, just because they didn't want me to die. That's the crap I put my family through. My dad didn't sleep for three nights at a time after he would come visit me in jail. That's the crap I put my family through. The crap that they had more peace of mind when I was locked up in a jail cell, at least because they knew I wasn't going to die out on the street. That's the crap that my alcoholism puts my loved ones through. So God saw fit that SEPTA officer, he'd been walking around with my picture in the brim of his hat the day before and recognized me. Needless to say, get arrested. I got slide tackled on, like Pele on the York Dauphin L platform, and I can laugh about it today. I did a significant amount of time that time. I mean, there wasn't going to be any slaps on the wrist, but even I spoke with two FBI agents when I got driven downtown that day, and I didn't see them again until I got sentenced 9 months later. Even then, I was getting blessings, because I was looking at like anywhere from the low end was 4 years to they could have just locked me up and threw away the kid, because I already had a felony. And the FBI agent got called as a witness to make a statement at my sentencing hearing 9 months later, and he got up and he said, "Your Honor, Mr. McGee grew up in an Irish Catholic family. I grew up in an Italian Catholic family. Mr. McGee went to Villanova. I went to Georgetown. Mr. McGee obviously suffers from some issues of alcoholism, drug addiction. We are we were recommending a mental health evaluation, but my dad died of the disease of alcoholism. But for the grace of God, there go I. This is the guy that took my statement when I got locked up. And I looked over at the U.S. attorney and her face was like white because she didn't notice what was about to happen. He said, "Your Honor, I'm not telling you to give him a slap on the wrist. Obviously, since he did what he did, 5 bank robberies, trying to kill himself. But he was like, he obviously needs help." And I did my time, came home. I would love to say that I got it that time. That's when I would start going through the steps and get 9 months sober, get this sober, and then I would start putting on years. I mean, as recently as just over 3 years ago, like, my life was, you hear about rocketing in the fourth dimension, it was beyond my wildest dreams. I was the executive chef of a restaurant in Fairmount, and I proposed to my best friend in New Orleans on May 1st of that year, and we're both in this program today still. But both of us back then had started putting that job and getting the things, all the things. The new apartment, the new this, the new car, that. The kid having parenting guilt trip wise, like just buying everything for the kids instead of getting them what they need. Until one day suddenly happened to both of us and we had 4 of the most miserable, when I tell you miserable, months. I watched my best friend almost die. She watched me almost die. It wasn't fun. And then we went away once. It didn't stick that time. We went away again. It stuck that time for her. Unfortunately for me. Because when I go away and I detox, like I said, I'm still left with myself without a solution. And I kept AMAing because I wasn't comfortable in my skin. Until I finally went away, and I would love to say that I stayed sober that time. I stayed sober for just under a year, and a week before I messed up, on November 12th of 2020, I had a 2-day relapse this time. 2 days. A week before, I sat in Frank's truck after I had done a rehab commitment with him, because the first half of that year, I was in the solution. The second half of that year, once we came out of that first total shutdown of COVID, I needed all the hours of work they were going to give me. We're shorthanded. We need to make the money up and blah, blah. I need. And I threw this program right out the window. And we talked, and I said, "I'm struggling." And he was like, "Well, you're not growing spiritually." He was like, "You can throw that big book out. I can tell you, I could sit here and not even open up the big book and discuss big with you all night. I don't even need the pages in front of me." But where's the practical application? And it also tells us we have to continue our spiritual growth. And he pointed that out that night, and Katie and I ordered a couple of spiritual books for me to start. But I was already too far gone at that point. I went to my favorite meeting, one of my favorite meetings in Fishtown on a Thursday. I showed up early. I got to the top of the steps, realized I was early, suddenly happened, and I was off. The worst thing that happened is nothing happened that first night, and I got paid the next day. And I was zigzagging back and forth from Northeast Philly to Kensington 5 times, and the first 3 times, lying to myself, "You're still going to go to work tonight. You're still going to go to work tonight." Then the last time I went down, I got something to bring me down so I didn't spend the rest of my money, and Needless to say, I ended up in an ambulance. I woke up in an ambulance because I had AFib too. I almost died the last time I got up. I was in the hospital for a week. No one was willing to take me rehab-wise because of that heart condition. And a buddy of ours, who manages a recovery house, took a shot on me knowing that I had not a pot to piss in at that point because work fired me. Well, they said they were going to shut down again anyway, but I knew I was about to get fired. And luckily, that's the best thing that happened to me, that I didn't have a job in that first couple months. I hustled to pay my rent and have some cigarettes and coffee, and that was it. And I jumped into this work. The last thing that, it was amazing that the set-aside prayer was the last thing that was read before I came up, because that was so huge in my recovery this time. The first time I sat down with my sponsor, he said, open up the back page of your book, and wrote the set-aside prayer down in the back of my big book. And he even said it to me. He was like, dude, he was like, you know the book. He was like, we have to get you into the practical application of it, and you need to stay in it. And what does that look like? Like, I knew my life was unmanageable. That's without question. I've always believed in a God, but I had to trust that He could take over my life and make that surrender and that decision in step three, and then get free in four and five. Like, four and five wasn't difficult this time. A couple years ago, the first time I did it, I was like, I'm never telling a dude everything I did or everything I'm resentful at. Or like, I grew up, especially as a man, you shove that shit down. No one gives a flying what you care about. Like, just go to work, provide for your family, and that's it. But like, this time around, like, that wasn't hard at all. The amends process was huge this time around. And I have a lot of amends still to make to this day. Like, my best friend Katie and we're still best friends, even though we're not together that way right now. And that's the beauty of this program too. Like, if you would ask me 2 years ago, and I know I'm all over the place, but if you would ask me 2 years ago if she needed to take a step back because she, for her sake and her program and her serenity, because there was a lot of damage against each other in that too, and a lot of mistrust. Because she got sober, and even though she understands better than like most of my other loved ones who don't suffer from this disease, I caused her a lot of pain all those times I AA made. And I accepted that she, and don't get me wrong, it's hard any given day sometimes too, but she's still my best friend. But like making the amends to her last summer was a powerful moment for me. And I had to clean up my side of the street I tried to control that situation when she first broke up with me. Like, how could you do this? We made a promise. Like, I'm not God. Like, she needed to do what was best for her, and like, I needed to accept that we're in different trajectories in our life right now, but, I mean, like I said, like, her kids, I consider them like my own. And I mentioned Josie. Unfortunately, I'm not a part of Josie's life right now because of all those relapses and because of a laziness on my part where I felt she was better off still without me. And just a couple months ago, I spoke at a meeting that like, a lot of men would have a hard time saying like their kid's stepfather was a great man and you felt privileged to have them in your kid's life. I said that and meant it because Ralph was a great person in Josie's life. He was a great stepfather to her and the father she needed when I couldn't be. And he passed away a couple weeks ago. And like, I know I have to step up and I wanted to step up in Josie's life for so long, but I have to trust God in that part of my life too. And that's a hard piece. Like, because I sit here and think like, well, I gotta go get a lawyer and I gotta go this. Am I taking it to God? I have to take everything to God. Everything. But like it wasn't even a couple weeks after I got to that house in 2020 where me and the guys at that house tried, and I'm not gonna say this for a pat on the back, but just some of the crazy God moments that have come up in my life over the last year and change. Like, we decided to go down Kensington on a whim on Thanksgiving and hand out. I think we cooked enough for like 50 platters. And after we did that, we're like, oh, we should do a bigger one on Christmas. So I called Dave, Shay's husband, who through his work has, works with the SEPTA police, and he was like, let me reach out to them and see, because we knew if we were going to do something that big, we didn't want to get kicked off the corner. Like, I'm telling you, like, it was a huge event. Like, box trucks of clothes, 700 platters of food, and like I said, like, Frank brings up to me all the time, he's like, help people because you want to help them, not because you need to. And I look at that as the sponsorship part too. Like, am I helping them just because I want to help them, or am I helping them because they're going to keep me sober? Because they're not. They're another human being. Do I get benefits out of helping other people? Sure. But I can't treat them like a bag of dope. Because I've been guilty of that in the past too. Like, alright, those three sponsees are the step four. I need a new guy. Today, I just asked God to put people in my life. Right now, I don't have any sponsees. Two of them relapsed recently. But getting back to that event, Dave called me an hour before it. And he said, do you remember Sergeant Carney? And I said, Carney, who's that? And he said, he's the guy that drove you from the York Dock and L stop down to the federal building downtown when you got arrested. And I said, I mean, I remember a guy driving me down. He said, well, he's the guy I reached out to telling him about your outreach tonight. And he recognized your name right away. And he said, oh, he's doing good. And Dave said, he's doing okay right now. And he was like, well, if he's doing something like that, Tommy's got the support of the SEPTA Police Department. Those are the crazy God moments that have happened to me, and that happened at 3 weeks sober. 3 weeks out of almost dying. And they kept happening and happening and happening. And I didn't start doing that outreach with a plan to like create a nonprofit, which we're thinking of doing. I did it just because I wanted to help people. And it's mushroomed into this amazing avalanche of not only do we do it once or twice a month, and it's organized, unlike it was those first few times. But I get to meet all these amazing people, not only just in recovery, but other people that are down there helping, and organizations like the Sunday Love Project, who I partner with and I help now as well, who don't even have any connection to Alcoholics Anonymous or recovery outside of they're just trying to help people. The same thing Frank kept saying to me over and over again. Help people because you want to help people. And I'm not going to lie, I get another day out of it. Like, that's not AA, but, like, it's part of my God thing. Because I've asked God what He wants me to do. And for some reason, I found purpose in doing stuff like that. Like, what this program has afforded me, and the solution has afforded me, is peace of mind. I know, don't get me wrong, I'd love to be a millionaire. And I hope I am someday. Everyone hopes that. Like, if you said you didn't want $1 million, I think you would be lying. But, I have a pretty good life. Like I said, I have a nice apartment in Old City. I work for an amazing company and I've been one of their best employees for over a year and a half now. I'm employable. But I also told them from the rip, my home group is on Sunday nights. And at the time I wasn't available on Wednesday nights too. And I stick to it. Unless, like, we're shorthanded right now, so, like, I had to stick around on Sunday a little longer than I normally have to, so I missed my home group on Sunday, but back in January when we were cutting hours, one of the owners gave me a template for a schedule, and he said, and he had my name on Sunday nights, so I said, absolutely not. He said, what do you mean? I was like, remember our first conversation with you and old chef? And I said, I'm not available on Sunday nights. And I told you why. And he said, yeah. And I was like, do you want your best employee to have a crack pipe in his mouth? And I hate to be that frank, but it's that serious. And he said, what are you talking about? I was like, I am one of your best employees because of that. I was like, but the minute I put this in front of that, I'm either going to die or you're going to want to fire me or I might rob you. Who knows? Every time I put that first one in me, it's like rolling dice or playing Russian roulette, whatever you want to call it. But the great thing, like I said, that peace of mind, like, I live in Old City. I went and took my dog to see my best friend on her lunch break and sat in Franklin. I recognize those little things today. The beauty of just sitting in Franklin Square today at lunch. Or when I take my dog to Race Street Pier and I get to sit there and just enjoy the quiet. I could never live with the quiet. It killed me. And then later this afternoon, I went and got a haircut, and I was walking down Arch Street, and anyone that's familiar with that area at 6th and Arch is the Federal Detention Center. I lived in that building for 9 months, looking out my window at the Liberty Bell and Independence Hall. I would literally stare at it almost every night. Talk about that juxtaposition of that symbolizes freedom, and I was sitting there in despair wondering how many years I was going to be in federal prison. And like today wasn't the first time I've walked past the federal detention center since I've been home. I walked by it a million times, like, but when I, those first couple years, I would avoid it like the plague, and even if we drove by it, that sinking sickness happened in my belly of disgust of what I had done, what I had put my family through, all those things. Today, when I walk by it, just like every time I've walked by it in the last year and a half, and it's not every day, I thank God for the freedom I have. Because today, I understand, like, I used to be so disgusted with my past, with what I had done. I mean, I bet almost everyone here didn't expect me to say I'm a former bank robber. But, and what I'd put my family through, and the last run, just being pretty much homeless and couch hopping and scared to go away again and panhandling outside of a Wawa. This, every time I got sober, I was disgusted until I finally, that's something I had to surrender to. And then I came to a realization with talking with my teachers, that becomes an asset for us. Because the new person that comes in after us, like, I mean, how many times have you gone to a rehab and, like, this person, like, speaking to attackers, man, a lot of people that work in rehabs nowadays are one of us, but the ones that aren't, but, like, I mean, it talks about it in the book, like, we can't talk to clergy and our family or a doctor, but sitting down with a person like us, instantly, that magic happens. And not that there are many bank robbers wandering around AA, but it's just that craziness. Whether it was something small for one of you, or something insane like I did, it's those things we do when we're not comfortable in our skin. And the stuff's taken away from us, our old solution. Unless, that's why I said I'm recovered, instead I'm in recovery, like, this solution has afforded me everything. I missed my grandmother's funeral because of this disease. Coming home, leaving Eagleville, when they were gonna let me just have someone pick me up to go to the funeral, no, I had to be part of the family, and like, and I meant it when I was leaving Eagleville, and when I met Katie, and I was on my way to that recovery house, in my heart of hearts, I believed that I was going to go to that recovery house, and I was going to be at my grandmother's funeral. That's how strong this disease is. Like that. That one. And I lied to myself that one, I'm going to take that one and I'm still going to go to a recovery house and they're not going to know. I didn't even make it to the recovery house. But the solution that I'm in today, I can tell someone that same story. Even though it disgusted me saying that out loud just a year ago. And they're going to understand because they went through something similar. Or it's going to help a newcomer that did the same. I said that word God a lot, and if there's any newcomers on Zoom or even here and you don't believe in God, I get it. But I mean, you can read Bill's story and just believe in a power greater than you to get you to that point. It's more about that decision, trust in that power greater than you. I mean, I'm not going to sit up here and say I go to God every single day. I forget some days. And most of the time, those are the days I'm screaming at the food runner at my work. Or I feel with conversations. But, like, some days, like, my power greater than me is Jerry Garcia's guitar playing in my ear. Or doing yoga before I go to work. I don't believe in the necessarily Catholic God that I grew up with anymore. I just believe that there's a creator up there. And I think that's afforded me that freedom too, because being an intelligent kid, I needed something tangible all the time. I needed to know how this worked and I needed to be able to control it. I believe there's something up there. And he created all of us, and that love of God is in each and every one of us. And I even see that on the streets when we do that work down in Kensington. That love and compassion. I mean, if you hate that word God, I get it. but get with someone to sit down and try and reach an understanding with something greater than you if you're gonna try and stay sober. But Sunday night, 7 o'clock at the Stepping Stones, we definitely need some help with that meeting. And I just want to thank Shay again and thank everyone for having me up here. Bye.
The group would like to thank Dan again for sharing his experience with us.